Casualty Insurance against Merge Healthcare Solutions. Mr. Ehlers.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I represent Carolina Casualty Insurance Company, which is seeking an appeal of two adverse rulings against Carolina on summary judgment motions in the District Court that relate to the scope of coverage provided under directors and officers and corporate liability insurance policy. In addition, Merge is seeking, as appellee, reversal of the court's ruling in regard to its bad faith claims. In regard to the issue of coverage, Carolina's position is that under air safety, it's only necessary for the court, only was necessary for the district court to look at two documents. The first is the policy, and the second is a fee award order that gave rise to the loss for which coverage is being disputed. If you look at the policy, it defines loss as including damages, judgments, settlements, and cost of defense, but it carves out from that definition several matters, including the multiplied portion of multiplied damages. If you take a look at the Massachusetts court order, the fee award order, it makes a couple of key points clear. First, the court was relying upon two Massachusetts cases in making its award that justify an award in this situation as an award of damages, and that's the Coggins and Pearson cases. So there's no question that the court, this Massachusetts court, considered its award to be an award of damages. The second point here is this fee award order, there's been a lot of discussion about whether it created a multiplied portion of multiplied damages. Our point here is the way the fee award was calculated was to first arrive at the basic lodestar amount and then for the court to apply a multiplier of 5. In our view, that created a clear multiplied portion of multiplied damages.
In the base lodestar, there's some multiplication going on, right?
There
you
is.
You take the hourly rate times the number of hours expended. Right.
Right. The difference there is that that's not an enhancement. That's the basic measure of damages.
All right. But there's to take the literal reading of that multiplied portion of multiplied damages the way you argue it, it seems to me that would apply to the base lodestar as well.
Well, I think the distinction here is that you're looking at a situation where the basic amount of damage, the basic amount necessary to compensate the plaintiff's lawyers for their work in this case, it was calculated using multiplication, but it was then enhanced. It was increased by multiplying it by 5.
That, and that's, I don't see that word enhancement in the policy. I don't. Where are you getting that?
It's from the court's order. So the different, I'm not sure if I've answered Your Honor's question.
No, you haven't. It's hard for me to see how the language multiplied portion of multiplied damage is unambiguous. It seems very ambiguous to me.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, we had damages that were enhanced. They were multiplied by 5.
Counsel, I must say I have trouble understanding why these are damages. Attorney's fees are awarded as part of cost. They're not awarded as damages.
The court in this case, in its fee award order, indicated that it was authorized to order these fees as damages. The court made it clear.
It doesn't answer my concern. Right? Your client conceded that it would pay fees or that it was obliged to pay these fees. But I don't see what makes them damages. Federal law is pretty clear. Fees are part of costs. They aren't part of damages. That's the reason for the American rule, that the parties ordinarily bear their own fees.
I think the distinction is when the fees are awarded against the other party,
no.
There are damages as to that party.
Federal courts award fees all the time. 1988 is a great example of that. Fees are awarded in 1983 litigation, in Title VII litigation, in antitrust litigation. They're never viewed as part of damages in any of those cases. They are awarded as part of costs. That's just the norm in federal practice. Now, why should this be treated differently?
Well, I believe that in the broader sense of the word damages, damages isn't defined in the policy, but a number of courts have looked at what damages means, and there is precedent for the term damages. I believe it was in the Excel case that's cited in the briefs for an award of attorney's fees constituting damages.
It is possible in principle. Another situation in which this comes up is whether the value of attorney's fees counts toward the amount in controversy for purposes of diversity jurisdiction. And the answer, by the way, is no, because attorney's fees are part of costs. There are a few very rare circumstances in which they are part of the plaintiff's relief. As, for example, when a contract provides that they're treated that way. But there's nothing in this contract that provides that attorney's fees are damages. Right, it would be easy to write an insurance contract that said, we will pay ordinary attorney's fees, but not any multiplier of attorney's fees. But there's nothing in this contract that says that.
Well, Your Honor, I guess if you dispel the premise that this award of attorney's fees was damages, which I think requires us to disregard the court's basis for awarding these fees. I mean, the court's
basis for awarding these fees was your client's concession that it would pay them.
Which makes it sound a little bit like part of a settlement. There's a settlement with... in some sense, between Amicus and the shareholders, that the fees are going to be paid outside of this so-called common fund. It sounds a bit like a settlement to me.
Well, there was a settlement, but what my client conceded was not that it would pay any fee award. My client was very clear on reserving its rights, and my client was clear on reserving specifically the definition of loss, including the carve-outs from that definition.
How did it do that? I'm not sure I understand that statement.
We're referring to a March 19 letter that's part of the record, Your Honor.
What's the letter say?
The letter said that
we reserve our rights.
The letter says more than reserving rights. The letter specifically quoted the definition of loss, including the carve-outs. And the letter was provided to provide an opinion as to one specific scenario, not an opinion as to what would happen if a lodestar multiplier was applied by the court. But it actually specifically addressed...
It didn't say anything about whether you're going to use the lodestar or some other method, did it?
Yes, it did. It said, in the event that a percentage of fund method would be used, but the funds for the fee award would not be taken out of the common fund, the policy would provide coverage. It didn't address lodestar, and it didn't address an enhancement multiplier. But it did reserve rights as to generally be able to assert the limitations included in the definition of loss.
Well, that's pretty ambiguous, too, I think. I wouldn't call that a very forthright statement of anything, but go ahead.
I'd like to move on to the extrinsic evidence. Really, we've discussed the March 19 letter and what that letter provided. There's also testimony that was provided by an expert named Tim Burns.
How does any of this extrinsic evidence affect the meaning of the policy? I understand that extrinsic evidence can affect the meaning of a contract if it deals with information the parties exchanged when they were negotiating the contract. But what people say and do after the contract has been signed can't affect the contract's meaning.
I agree, Your Honor.
So what's the point?
Well, we argued that the extrinsic evidence should not have been considered. We also argue that Mr. Burns did not have a foundation. He's a policyholder attorney, but he also never had any experience in dealing with a case where the multiplied portion of multiplied damages, where the scope of that phrase was at issue, or although he's had experience.
That brings up another question. I'm sorry to now take things out of order. But are there any cases where state courts have interpreted the phrase multiplied portion of multiplied damages as applied to awards of attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor, there is not. The only case that either side cited that even used the phrase.
Both parties haven't cited any. I was just asking whether you had conducted an exhaustive search to see whether there were any.
Yes, Your Honor, both sides did. And the only case that we came up with was a case where that issue was agreed upon.
Yeah, okay. I mean, too bad. I mean, it would be nice if there were, but we have to deal with the world as it is.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may go back to the issue of Mr. Burns' testimony. His conclusion was that the various carve-outs from the definition of loss should all be construed to be addressing punitive situations, punitive damage situations, and the uninsurability of damages. But it doesn't make sense if you look at the list of carve-outs to conclude that all of the carve-outs apply to those two situations because those two items are separate list items in the list of carve-outs. And in fact, punitive damages are that carve-out has been eliminated to the extent that those damages are insurable by an endorsement to the policy. So it doesn't make sense to look at the policy as a to this list of carve-outs as a whole and say that each one of them addressed the situations that are provided by two of the specific carve-outs. It seems that Merge recognized this. Merge argues that all of these carve-outs apply to non-compensatory types of damages. But it's not clear that the Massachusetts court was ordering the enhancement of these fees in order to provide compensatory damages. The Massachusetts court said, it was rewarding the plaintiffs for taking on the risk of the case, and it was also specifically rewarding the plaintiffs for acting as a private attorney general in the context of proxy contests. So it's not clear that this grant, this excess grant of fees, the multiplied portion of the fees, was intended to be compensatory in the first place. Briefly, I'd like to also address the assertions of bad faith. We contend, and the district court agreed, that there was a bona fide issue related to coverage in this case, and our denial of coverage for that portion of fees was not vexatious and unreasonable. Second, in regard to their common law claim for bad faith, most common law claims under Illinois law are preempted by Section 155. The exception to that would be a situation where there is a failure to settle or a breach of the duty to settle. That duty did not arise in this case. There's no indication that there was ever a risk of damages in excess of the policy limits, and there was never an offer made by plaintiffs for us to accept or a demand by Merge for us to accept an offer within policy limits. That simply never happened in this case. There's a lot of other discussion in the various briefs about that Merge has submitted about settlement negotiations that were improper. That didn't happen in this case either. If you look at the interrogatory responses, it indicates, well, first of all, Carolina is allowed to associate in settlement discussions under Section 6B of its policy. But second of all, the actual conversations were very, very limited, and the issue was raised as to whether it might be possible to settle without any prejudice to the insureds, which was expressly raised in those conversations, and without using any of Merge's money, although that's been asserted in this case, to see whether the undisputed portion, the basic Lodestar portion, which Carolina did acknowledge coverage for, could be settled, but without prejudicing the insured's rights. That was, it never led to anything, but there was never a settlement offer made, and it didn't do anything to prejudice the insureds in this case. If there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schumer.
May it please the court. William Schumann on behalf of Merge Healthcare Solutions, Inc. We are the appellee and the cross-appellant here. The district court, Your Honor, properly held that there was no genuine issue of material fact and dispute, properly ruled that Carolina had to pay the entire fee award rendered by the Massachusetts court. We ask that that be affirmed.
Was any argument made in the district court based on the Buchanan case?
I'm sorry.
Based on the Buchanan case, I don't understand how your client is a prevailing party. The Supreme Court held in Buchanan, in order to be a prevailing party in litigation, you have to win the litigation. It's not enough that the litigation be a catalyst for some other event in the world. The other event in the world that provided the benefit to shareholders was the competing bid. There was no success in the litigation that provided the benefit, and under the Supreme Court's decision in Buchanan, therefore, your side was not the prevailing party, and there should not have been an award of attorney's fees.
Your Honor, I need to let me just correct what my side is, because our side.
Well, of course, your side is now both sides following the merger.
No, Your Honor, we have the plaintiffs, who I agree with you, are not responsible for the result, and that being argued in the Massachusetts appellate court, because the claim is that fees, the initial claim was that they don't even aren't even entitled to any. The court in Massachusetts ruled that they were.
I know the trial court did, and I know that an appeal was pending. So one of the arguments on that appeal is that no fees at all should have been awarded. Is that one of the arguments?
One of the arguments.
I had thought, maybe obviously wrongly, that the argument concerned the amount of the fees and not their awardability.
Both arguments were made.
Okay.
No, both arguments were made.
All right. Go ahead. Never mind at this point if that argument is actually being made.
Yes. So to go to the language of there was a question asked, I believe, by Judge Cudahy, and the response had to do with, does the language of the March 19 letter address this issue? And they were talking about how it was only a portion of it, whether it's the percentage of the fund, it didn't address anything else. The language of the letter, when Carolina said, here's what we will do, Carolina said the following: the insurer agrees that the policy covers reasonable plaintiff's attorney's fees awarded by the court, regardless of whether or not the fees are calculated as a percentage of the bump-up amount or the so-called common fund. So the carrier is saying, yes, we'll pay. Yes, it doesn't matter how it's calculated. Yes, whatever the court does, we'll pay. That's what settled the lawsuit, frankly. That's what allowed the parties to go on, because remember that the merge, better offer, if you will, was being held up, was being, in effect, held hostage by the plaintiffs, who said, we are going to ask for an escrow if you won't agree that the money has to come on top of the $26 million. And that prevented the amicus board from being able to find a superior offer. And so everybody said, we must go to the carrier. We believe it's covered. I think Your Honor is completely right. The there are cases in the Massachusetts opinion that do reference attorney's fees as damages. But I will tell you that there are some on both sides. Your point in 1988 is exactly right. They're viewed as costs. It's also proper under this provision when it says, because remember, there's no definition of damage. It's a definition of loss, which includes damage. We win here anyhow, because even the multiplied portion of multiplied damages, one can disagree all one wants with what the Massachusetts court did in terms of the calculation and the number. But they followed Massachusetts law. They found, the judge found, what he believed was a reasonable attorney's fee. Not a reasonable attorney's fee if you viewed it as damages. If you did, It wasn't like he said, okay, here's damages of $630,000. Now we'll give some punitive or additional amount. He decided that the factor to apply to get to the reasonable rate was a 5, and he got to $3.15 million, and he said that's the reasonable attorney fee. When you look at this letter, there are not two ways to read that, to read it. The carrier said, yes, we will pay the fee award by the court regardless of the methodology. There is no other way to read that. And frankly, when I started to say...
So that's not a separate commitment. You lost on that claim, right? That's a separate commitment, but that's the way Carolina reads its own policy.
Yes, we made an initial claim that was, number one, we were right under the policy. We said in count two initially that this is a separate additional agreement. The judge says no, it relates to the policy. She found that we need to have evidence on what the policy means. And we came in, and in our brief, we said 100 to nothing. It is 100 to nothing. We have the witnesses said, here's what it means and here's what the documents say. We had an expert, they had none. We had witnesses, they have none. Our argument... An expert on custom and usage in the industry about whether or not multiplied portion of multiplied damages can ever be considered as part of something that is excluded in that definition of loss. This is a person who has dealt with that term.
If there are no cases on the point, how does one resolve such a question?
By custom and usage, number one. And that's what this expert did. And frankly, this was the person precisely in position, having dealt with the term all the time. Multiplied portion of multiplied damages is one of the cases we cited, and you asked the question, it is true, nobody has found a case, there is no case that applies to the multiplied portion of multiplied damages and excludes attorney's fees. That's because nobody has ever raised this argument before. No, there are no cases out there, and our expert agreed that he hadn't been in a case like that, but he has dealt with that, with those terms all the time, and he knows how it's interpreted. And as I say, when you take a look at it, multiplied portion, you have to. The Foster case was a Northern District of Ohio case, and it was an antitrust case. And there's one word in there that's a little bit of help because they're talking about, and that was a coverage case. Okay, so that one, not an attorney's fees, but the issue was, are we covering? Let me make up numbers for a moment. $1 million, the antitrust damage, or are we covering the extra $2 million? And the court said, tell me what's owed. That's the million. That's covered. Tell me the trebling amount. That's the multiplied portion of multiplied damages. This Massachusetts judge, pursuant to what everybody agreed, said, here is what is owed the attorney's fees. Everybody agreed that's what's going to be paid. And how did he calculate it? He used the method that the Massachusetts courts use, which involves an analyzing not only rates times hours, but whether or not he believes that in order to get to reasonable, he has to use a factor to increase it. We've seen, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, we've seen that especially in some of the 1988 cases, sometimes they use a factor under one. Sometimes you have a plaintiff come in who gets a judgment in its favor but loses 10 out of 11 claims. That leads, if you were to take their words literally, that leads to a nonsensical result. Among our points is we think that not only have we demonstrated through the evidence that it is, if you noticed in their brief, they said our evidence is irrelevant. That's still their position. We have, as I said, an expert. We have witnesses. We have the documents. Your Honor, we have the deposition the broker's affidavit. Now, that's not unimportant, and I'll tell you why. This is an independent person who, in fact, the carrier in the introductory language at the top of page one of the policy says, if you want to know what the policy means, talk to the broker. When we deposed the claims adjuster, she confirmed, her name was Noster, she confirmed, she said, you know what, if you want to know what the policy means, talk to your broker. We don't get involved in those conversations. That's in the policy, it's in the depositions. They're telling you, talk to the broker. Well, the broker gave us an affidavit confirming exactly our position. If somebody remanded this case for trial and said, okay, Carolina, put a case on, they have nothing. We have witnesses. We have documents. That's why our position is this isn't just we win, although we do. We crossed the line from no genuine issue of material fact. And frankly, there cannot, because they didn't give you one fact, not one. But besides that, then you go on to our 155 claim.
I think it is really inappropriate for one lawyer to repeatedly point to another during oral argument.
I apologize.
Here during the first case.
I apologize. The section 155 standard is no bona fide argument. So we have to persuade you that we've moved from no genuine issue to no bona fide argument. Judge Conlon pointed out they didn't even raise this issue until after the size of the fee was known. And we cited cases that talk about the fact that if they change a position without any basis, that was a perfect example of what is a vexatious refusal to pay. If they have no basis, and they have no basis, when they write in a letter that settles the case, that they will pay reasonable attorney's fees set by the court, regardless of the method, and they said regardless of whether the percentage of the fund is used, there's frankly nowhere for them to go. They changed when they got a big, when the number issued was large. And there's no basis for that. They never came up with an argument. If this is what they believe, think about what the text of that letter says if you believe what they believe now. Was that deception? You talked about the fact that they, and the one thing that their witnesses did say is, yes, Carolina knows how to write an exclusion when they intend to exclude it. That's in the deposition transcript. Well, they plainly didn't exclude this. There is nothing in the record.
To me, is understandable. There's a first time for everything. We have something that's apparently sufficiently rare. It's never been litigated before. It's not really surprising that there's no special exclusion addressing it in the policy.
May I suggest that there's another alternative view to that, which is it has never been challenged before? That nobody, which is what our expert says, which is to say that when you're looking at multiplied portion of multiplied damages, by definition, you have to figure out what are the damages if you're going to take that view, and then the multiplied portion, what's compensatory? Well, this court, if you view it as damages, this court said 3.15 was this judge's view of compensatory. That was the damage. You and I can agree about whether it is costs, whether, frankly, it is the settlement, which they, in the definition of loss, they pay, whether, indeed, it's a judgment, because the court enters a judgment on the number, which they said they'd pay. In every way that you slice it, you end up with there is no way that multiplied portion of multiplied damages knocks out a portion of the reasonable attorney's fees. If the judge had said, I'm doing reasonable attorney's fees plus, okay, but the judge said in order to get to reasonable attorney's fees, I have to consider these extraneous factors, and then I get to my number, and then I'm issuing an award, and it's reasonable attorney's fees. And there isn't two ways. So I would say to Your Honor, I'm not surprised one iota that there's no case out there. No one has had the nerve to say this. That's our belief. That's why I believe, frankly, that we passed the threshold of Section 155. Because there is no bona fide argument, and the history of absence of cases indicates that we're right, not that they're right, or that it's a close call. Let me just touch on the bad faith claim, although we briefed it. What we believe that we successfully did is demonstrate that the conduct, again, where's the needle? We think past no genuine issue of fact. We believe no bona fide argument. Now you get to bad faith. Well, Section 155 preempts bad faith claims except the sliver, which has to do with settlement conduct. And I agree with Mr. Ehlers about the general nature where oftentimes you get bad faith claims if you fail to settle within limits. But take a look at the wrongdoing that we allege in two respects that relate to settlement. Number one, for them to look at us and say, we are refusing to pay 80% of the judgment. We'll pay 20, not 80. And then go to the, so they're denying coverage. Then go to the carrier, call them up and say, will you take 20%? What if they had said yes? And the case law out there talks about the fact that if they, the carrier that denies coverage no longer has the right to associate with settlement. How does that even make sense that they can go do a deal when they've told us they're not paying? And the second piece of the settlement conduct that fits is the notion that March 19 letter settled the case. We believe, deceptively, if you believe their view of the language, why isn't it pretty straightforward for them, with all the negotiation, the sentence that we keep referring the court to, which says regardless of whether the fees are calculated as a percentage of the bump up amount. The only other one, by the way, really that's followed is Lodestar. That sentence, if you look at what we cited in the record, you'll see the March 19 letter, but you'll see drafts of the March 19 letter, and that sentence is redlined into the final version. It was specifically discussed between all the parties and put in that regardless language. And frankly, in their brief, when they say that, yeah, that's true, we said we would pay reasonable attorney's fees, but, and I think they said it here, we didn't say we'll pay any reasonable attorney's fees. To me, again, if that's their argument, I say to you, that's enhancing, speaking of enhancing, that's enhancing my argument of vexatious refusal to pay. They're taking the position that they don't have to pay us because of the word any. Yes, we agreed to pay reasonable fees, but not any reasonable fees. Who is supposed to understand that secret intent if it had any basis? And if you say, well, that's...
vexatious refusal point. The judge here said that their position was reasonable. Did he give any reasons or analysis of why it's reasonable?
Judge Conlon gave one example, which was because one of our issues about why it was unreasonable was this issue of settlement negotiations, and that we said, you know what, you can't deny coverage and then call up the carrier without our being involved, without our permission, because we call up the other side and try to settle it. Judge Conlon cited the provision that was cited to you that says a carrier can associate, so that she didn't find that episode at the level of offensiveness than do we. But my point to your honors is that when you deny coverage, and I believe the case law supports this, you lose that right. It's nothing more basic than they breached their contract, in our view, if we're right, and they can't then go ahead and insist on the right to settle. And so that was one of the issues. The other was she didn't exactly say anything more that I recall about where that line was that she was satisfied. In other words, she's fine with no genuine issue, but was there a bona fide argument? Frankly, the only way you get to bona fide is, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, if you indulge the notion that multiplied portion of multiplied damages is even debatable. And when, you know, she said at first glance... And then she went on to say why we were right. Because at first glance, it's a little bit intoxicating to look at that language and to see what the Massachusetts court did and say, well, there is multiplication. But you go past first glance, you allow us discovery, and you get to a score which, in my humble judgment, is 100-0. If you had to get if the other side had to put on evidence to demonstrate that there was any plausibility, what would they do? What document? They have none. What witness? They have none. Carrie Cope, who's the lawyer that wrote the March 19 letter, so what was in her head? They have agreed that they will never call her. She's never submitting evidence. She's never going to give an affidavit. It's in the record. The only two people who they had four that they said have knowledge. Two of them they said they're never calling. The other two we deposed, and the two that we deposed, which were the underwriter and the claims agent, Noster and Heavier, they said, number one, we don't know, Heavier didn't remember. She was a blank slate, she said. Noster and Heavier both said, we've never dealt with the language. If you've got a carrier that's taking a position about what the language means, and they name their two most important employees that say they know the most, and those two people stand up in a deposition and they say, we have no idea. They said, we don't even know the difference between the two methodologies, percentage of the fund and Lodestar. They said they don't know. They don't know if it's covered. They don't know if attorneys' fees are covered. They knew nothing. So if you look at our record and you look at their record, we are absolutely entitled to summary judgment, and we believe that we crossed that line with a couple of touchdowns to spare on the fact that they don't have a bona fide argument. Frankly, unless you buy the notion of this multiplied portion, the mere words being in play, if you don't automatically buy that, they have nowhere to go. There has never been a case that had so much on one side and so little on the other because they're riding that horse completely. Bear with me one moment. The Massachusetts court. I also would suggest that and I know you have, when you look at what the Massachusetts judge did, he is very careful in explaining that his goal, his mission, is to set a reasonable attorney's fee. And he decides, what way am I going to use? He says Lodestar. And in the Volkswagen case, the First Circuit case, that pretty recently confirms that is what Massachusetts does. And the Lodestar says you don't have to apply a fairness factor, but it's part of the methodology. You can look at it and say, I'll use one. In other words, I won't adjust it. But it's part of the methodology. It's what allows them to decide what's fair once I do the initial step. So the everything in the Massachusetts judge's opinion confirms this. If the court has, it looks like I'm out of time. Unless the court has any further questions, which I'd be happy to try to answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Ehlers?
First of all, I understand that the court may disagree with our conclusion about what constitutes damages. I do want to point out we did rely upon some case law. In addition to the Massachusetts court's own statement of what it was doing to reach the conclusion that it did, the fee award did constitute damages, we cited the American Family Mutual case. We also cited the XL Specialty case, in which the court had specifically included attorney's fees were damages under the terms of a management liability policy. So it wasn't as though we pulled this out of thin air. And also the outboard marine case indicates that the word damages includes liability of either an equitable or legal nature and appears to indicate a broader conception of that term, but in the context of a liability insurance policy. Second, the notion that Carolina's letter said we are going to pay fees regardless of the method used to calculate them can only be reached if you take a sentence out of context. If you read the entire letter, it's clear that Carolina wasn't intending to waive limitations that are included in the definition of loss. They expressly reserved it. It was expressly stated in the letter, including the multiplied portion of multiplied damages. And the notion that what caused the court to use an extrinsic ambiguity analysis in this case. There was never an agreement to pay any reasonable fees. That's an extrapolation working backwards from that March 19 letter. It didn't happen. And the last point I'd like to make, there was no settlement offer made for uncovered fees. We had a situation where we acknowledged coverage for a portion of the fees. We did deny coverage for another portion of the fees. The settlement discussions did not purport to settle the uncovered claims. And the question was raised, could we maybe try to figure out a way to settle the undisputed portion without prejudicing the insureds? But that was the only discussion. If your honors have any additional questions.
No. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.